Last time I spoke, which seems like it's forever, I told you I would give a second installment on Corinthians. By the time we had services canceled twice that I was going to speak due to snowstorms, which we had another one yesterday, by the way. We had 6-7 inches, but it's warm today. I thought we're too close to Passover and unleavened bread, and I don't want to talk about that now. I want to talk about Passover and unleavened bread, so I got something else for today. Appearances can be deceiving. There's a title for whoever needs titles back there in the back. Appearances can be deceiving. All right, let's see if I can make this happen. I could do it on a different computer, but we'll see what happens here. Nope, that didn't work. There's something I want to do here. Maybe this will work. Here we go.
The wolf in sheep's clothing. A wolf found it very difficult to get at the sheep because of the vigilance of the shepherd and his dogs. But one day, he found the skin of a sheep that had been flayed and thrown aside. So he put it on over his own pelt and strolled down among the sheep. The lamb of the sheep, whose skin the wolf was wearing, began to follow the wolf in sheep's clothing. The wolf led the little lamb away and made a meal of her. For some time, he succeeded in deceiving the sheep and enjoying hearty meals. Moral: appearances are deceptive.
I'm sure you all recognize that one. Aesop. Aesop apparently was a slave, or had been a slave. And apparently a wise slave, supposed to be deformed, all kinds of other things about him I didn't know. But he had a lot of wisdom and some clever ways of sharing that wisdom in his fables. What's the moral here? Well, appearances can be deceiving. You can't always believe what you think you see or what you think you hear. Reality might be different. This seems to be something that society recognizes because we have lots of expressions. We have fairy tales. We have stories that talk about this a lot, though we may not do so well at putting it into practice. That's why these stories are there, right? Because we know enough to know that we have weaknesses here, but it's still a weakness, and it has been throughout human history, and that's why we have the stories and the fables. We have expressions like, you can't judge a book by its cover. You've heard of that one. Anybody know who coined that phrase? If I say Mary Ellen Evans, Mary Ann Evans, is that her name? Mary Ann Evans, would that help? How about George Eliot? That's Mary Ann Evans was George. She wrote under George Eliot to be taken seriously in the 19th century in England. It's in one of her books, and somebody was discussing Daniel Defoe's, what is it? I got it here somewhere if I can read. I'll tell you what. My notes are showing up in really small print for some reason. Maybe I can make them bigger. No, can't. Daniel Defoe's book on something about the devil, the history of the devil. And he said, it's got a pretty binding, but you can't judge a book by the cover. That was her expression as an author in that book. Once again, it shows that we ought to know better. We have expressions like this: don't judge a book by its cover. But why do we have that expression? Because we tend to judge books by their covers. We tend to judge things by their outward appearance. That's just part of the human condition. It seems to be human nature to worry about how we appear to others. And not only that, but it seems to me that part of our nature also is to believe the deceit of others that are doing the same thing. Or else we wouldn't have to say these kinds of expressions all the time. Not only do we seek to deceive, but we seem to want to believe the deceit of others. It's just part of our human condition. We have stories about it. See, God, on the other hand, says that we need to look to the heart. We need to look to the inside. We have stories about that, too. I've never seen this movie or play or even read the book or whatever it started out as, but I'm sure many of you have. And can somebody briefly, you know, what's going on here? What, somebody that has seen it and knows it, want to give us a 1-2-minute summary? Some mother? or Leah, do you know it? You don't want to? Oh, come on. All right. I can try. I've never seen it.
I will.
Okay, sure. Go ahead. Okay, he doesn't end up this looking like this. He ends up his, okay, all right. Thank you. Thank you for filling me in there. I'm sure it's wonderful. I'll see it somewhere on Broadway or see a movie. But see, we have that story that there's value in looking to the heart. We have stories like this. This isn't the only one. And that's a godly principle that we need to look to the heart. We have expressions like beauty is only skin deep. I don't know where this came from. I tried to find out. I don't know. That didn't seem to identify. That's a concept that's as old as the hills. It's at least as old as Proverbs, when it talks about the lips of an adulteress or honey smoother than oil is her speech. But in the end, she's bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death. So it shows that it looks good on the outside, but it's not good. In the 20th century, Dorothy Parker put it this way, beauty is only skin deep, but ugly goes clean to the bone. That's the way it is, you know, deep down inside. That ugly's there. Well, amazingly enough, when you read the Bible, when I read the Bible, I've found that there are themes that go through the Bible. And I've touched on some of them in some messages I've given before. But when you read from cover to cover, you find out one of those themes has to do with not trusting outward appearance. It's in the whole Bible. That's what's interesting about it to me, that it's there. It's there from beginning to end. We are particularly prone to judging others or any situation by outward appearance. This theme runs from the beginning of the book to the end of the book, and it's also a good theme for now, around the time of Passover and unleavened bread, because this is a time of year when we typically look inside of ourselves and ask God to help us get rid of the things that are not like him. Get rid of those things that are down on the inside, the ugly that is down underneath the skin. And to get our insides in tune with God and his ways, as opposed to just trying to look good, which is the way society is. And I would suggest that even in my lifetime, it's a lot worse now than it was when I was a kid. And certainly a lot worse than when the Bible was written. We are very, very superficial. And I don't have to, I'm preaching to the choir here, you know that. So what I'd like to do is explore this topic of dealing with the outward deceitful appearances, the appearances that can be deceiving, and look at how the Bible deals with that. We don't have time to look at everything, we're not even going to try, but I want to look at a few select spots and see what we can learn from it. Now here's a couple of pen and ink drawings. The one on the left represents, anybody want to guess what they might be? Well, they're trees. They're definitely trees. I don't know what species they're supposed to be. That's not critical. Tree of life and the tree of knowledge of good and evil. This is someone's, David Teague, if any of you know him. He and his wife were at our house this past weekend, and as a gift, he left a couple of prints and also these, which I took a picture of. So this is his, these are metaphors of David's for the tree of life on the left and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil on the right. Anybody get the metaphor that's on the right there? I think it's clever. What's it look like? What do you see there? Hands. And the hands are, in David's mind, grasping. It's the idea of grasping, wanting something, or perhaps something that's not yours. That's his metaphor for the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So I just thought I'd share them with you because I want to talk about one. Let's see if I had any notes here. My notes, for some reason, turned out really small here, and I can't zoom them up. Oh, I'm trying to that's why I'm trying to treat it like a touch screen. I guess you can't do that if it's not. It doesn't work, does it? Whoa, that's even smaller. Let's go this way. No, that didn't help. In Genesis 3, we go right to the beginning of the book. If you want to read the book from cover to cover, we start in Genesis. It says the woman saw, okay, appearance, that the tree was good for food, and it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was desirable to make one wise, and she took from its fruit. So it looked good, yet it was destined to take all of humanity off track for the rest of humanity's history until God intervenes with the return of the Messiah. So right here in the beginning, where foundational and fundamental matters are addressed, we see that part of the problem is, and maybe a big part of the problem is, with human beings, is that we tend to look at something, believe what we think we see, and we think we know best. We think we can look, it looks good, must be good. And we reject knowledge to the contrary, or revelation to the contrary. To me, when you see something in the beginning of the book of Genesis, it's indicative that this is foundational to the way humans are. So this, Eve's actions and Adam's actions to follow are typical of the human condition, that we are going to think for ourselves, look and say, hey, this looks good to me, and reject any evidence to the contrary or anybody else's opinion, and perhaps take matters into our own hands. At least that's what Eve did. That's showing that we have an inclination to be that way. Now, we've got to go all the way to the end of the book to find out the identification of the serpent. Who is the serpent supposed to represent? It says the great dragon in Revelation 12, verse 9, was cast down, the serpent, who is called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. So we got to go to the back of the book, find out who is represented by the serpent. And guess what? When we know who that serpent represents, it shouldn't be surprising to find out that this particular individual is also one who specializes in representing himself as something he's not. He is the expert. He's the, what do you want to say, the epitome, I'm sure there's a good word, I can't think of it. He's the one who's best at this, whatever. The dean of people that want to make themselves out to look like something that they're not. Because Satan, it says, Paul's talking about false prophets in 2 Corinthians, and he says, it shouldn't be surprising that these false prophets look like somebody that's honorable and that we should listen to, because even the devil disguises himself as an angel of light. So that's his nature, and that's his game, too, to make something look better than it is. And so we as human beings tend to want to make ourselves look better than we are. We want to believe other people when they make themselves or try to make themselves look better than they are. That's the nature of the game. That's the nature of human life. So that's the reason why we are likely to be deceived and why we are likely to deceive also ourselves. Our adversary is the best deceiver. He's the dean of all of them. And he presents himself as a source of enlightenment. We have the enlightenment. Now, certainly there was a lot of enlightening that went on in the enlightenment, but part of the problem with what we call the enlightenment of the 18th century was, I guess 18th, maybe before that, but was that in the minds of some, we don't need God anymore. And that's certainly a problem. And as a result, much of what makes the world go round is based on deceit. I don't think I'd have any argument in this room about that. That's my observation. Deceit, bad reasoning. I just bought a really neat little book. I haven't read the whole thing. It's the illustrated book of bad arguments or something like that. It doesn't have every possible logical fallacy in it, but it's got a lot of them. Written by someone much younger than I am that's new to the subject. but it's still well done. This deceit that makes the world go round, if you want to put it that way, that is the leaven that we need to be leaving behind during these next few weeks. That's what we need, want to think about, this deceitfulness. And I'll get more specific here in a minute. Now, God realized that it was a problem that's inside. You know, he's not stupid, right? He made us. He knows how we are. And the writers of the Old Testament realized that too, especially when you get to the prophets. But in Deuteronomy already, we're reading, "Oh, that they had such a heart in them that they would fear me." The problem isn't that we don't have decent laws. The problem isn't that we don't have a good governmental structure. The problem isn't that we don't have good land to live in. The problem is in the heart. The problem is in the heart. It's on the inside, not on the outside. It's on the inside. And we read that, you know, I could have found, you know, examples of that in other parts of the Torah, but I picked Deuteronomy because it's the one that's the most clearly put. So let's take a look at some of the symbolism. It's a matter of the heart. The change must happen from within, not on the outside. We can't just act like we've changed. That doesn't work. It doesn't work in the long run. So it's really fitting that during the days of unleavened bread and during the time that comes before it, that we focus on what we are putting inside ourselves. You know, we are eating unleavened bread, right? And I talked about that before. It's the days of unleavened bread. It's not the days of not eating leavened bread. It's the days of eating unleavened bread. So that picture is putting something inside of us. So the whole time, this period of time now leading up to the Passover and that week, are weeks to focus on what's going on inside of us. And that's not comfortable. I mean, you've been doing it, and I've been doing it, and it's not comfortable. Because when we're honest, we realize, oh, you know, I try to put on a good face and a good show, but there's rottenness inside, as we'll get to one of those scriptures later. In one place, Jesus compared leaven to doctrine of the Sadducees and Pharisees. In Luke chapter 12 that I have here on the slide, he said to his disciples, "Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. But there is nothing covered up that won't be revealed, and nothing hidden that will not be known." So in the end, covering up, making things look good on the outside, that's not going to work. It's not going to get it in the long run. And that was Jesus' point. It doesn't last. There's nothing you cover up now that won't be uncovered later. You know, the prophecies talk about the world being destroyed in flames, you know, a new heaven and a new earth. You know, whatever things made of is going to become evident. That's the principle involved there. Not just, you know, our works, or, you know, definitely our works, your works, my works, but the whole earth. So leaven is compared to hypocrisy by Jesus. What is hypocrisy? I've done a sermon on that before, probably not here. Anybody, just for fun, anybody know where that term comes from? Jim, you know where that term comes from? Hypocrisy or hypocrite? That's exactly what it is. It's someone who doesn't practice what they preach. Typically, it only works in one direction, though. You don't normally say, "Oh, that guy's a hypocrite," when he's acting bad and he's really good at home. It's usually the other way around. But I don't want to take too much time. In Greek drama, you had one actor and you had a chorus. And the dialogue, if there was really, you wouldn't call it a dialogue, but the actor would say certain things. The chorus would be like the overseeing, whatever. You know. And of course, the only comments that are going on are the chorus response. Later on, there was this other actor, an under actor, hypo is under, an under actor or an under, I don't know what the other term would be. But this person would have a dialogue. It was the beginning of dialogue in Greek drama, is to have the second actor and the chorus. And so that person was the hypocrite, just the second actor. That's all it meant, an actor. And we have this, so we use the term today for people who are acting. And all of us, to one degree or another, are guilty of that. Because it's the nature of human beings. Now, what's the antidote? What's the solution to hypocrisy? It's unleavened. Right? We have leaven, that's hypocrisy. Then what does unleavened picture? 1 Corinthians 5, verse 8. "Let us celebrate the feast, not with old leaven, not with the leaven of malice and wickedness." That's what Paul associates it with, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. So if on the inside we want to replace hypocrisy with sincerity and truth, you know, being real, right? Being really good, really doing, you know, thinking the right thoughts, having the right motivation. The Pharisees, for all of the things that you see Jesus complaining, and I've brought this up before, the Pharisees were decent in a lot of ways. They took care of their widows. They did a lot of good things. But Jesus said the motivation was terrible in general. That's a broad brush. Some Pharisees followed him. Some Pharisees joined the church. But in general, the Pharisees had wrong motivations for what they did. They were hypocrites. Sincerity and truth is being real, having real affiliation with God on the inside, not just looking like it on the outside. What do we see in the Bible? Well, has man been good at this, having sincerity and truth on the inside? Well, certainly. No, we don't see that, do we? We see the opposite of that. So I just want to touch on a couple of things, and then we get to the New Testament. I just want to spend the rest of the time in one book. You remember this in 1 Samuel chapter 16. God said to Samuel, when he saw Jesse's big hulking sons and all these good guys, it kind of reminded him of Saul. Remember, Saul was handsome. Saul was head and shoulders above everybody else. Saul was the guy that looked like a king. But God rejected his dynasty. God rejected that and said, we're going to start with somebody else. And who did he pick? Well, he picked David, you know, somewhat little guy. Not that he was weak or a weakling. He was strong. He was a shepherd. But he was not the most imposing one. And God said to Samuel, I don't see like a man sees. Man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. Okay, so here we are way back in 1 Samuel, way back in the beginning near the beginning of the Israelite monarchy. We have the writings, the history of the time saying, look, you know, God looks at something different than the way man does. Man looks at the outward appearance, God looks at the heart. That theme goes through, as I said, especially in the prophets. I think I'm only going to mention one, but you see it in the prophets again and again, where the prophets say, you know, Israel's in captivity because, yes, Sabbath breaking and idolatry for sure, but also not taking care of their neighbor, you know, doing other things, and not being just in their judgment. Jeremiah said, the heart is more deceitful than anything else and desperately sick, and who can understand it? Now, I'm taking that out of context, but if you read the context, it's okay. It fits. Because he's talking, you know, it fits with what we're talking about. The question is, who can understand it? But you know what? To a certain degree, lots of people understand that. Wow, how can I say that? Who understands the way the heart works, you think? At least to a certain degree. Give me some categories of people or some professions of people that understand how our heart works and use it to make money or use it to use us to get what they want. Any examples?
Psychiatrists.
Huh? Psychiatrists. Well, they're supposed to understand how it works. There's an example. I don't know how they use us.
Advertising.
Madison Avenue, advertising. They understand how it works. Now, they might be guilty of the same problems, but they understand how mine works, and they try to get me to buy something that I don't want. Yes?
Lawyers
maybe, yeah. You've got to deal with lawyers. All kinds of professions know how it works.
Law enforcement.
Well, yeah, they have to. It's part of their job. I wasn't even going down that direction. How about any other idea? People that understand how it works. And you, who in society... What groups of people, you're saying lawyers and psychiatrists, okay. What other groups of people or groups of professionals or groups of, professional might be the wrong word, but who else needs to use you to get what they want?
Fortune tellers,
okay, that's an example. How about, huh? Politicians, that's one of my big ones. Yeah, politicians. In our society, they have to be elected. So they've got to make all of us think that we're deciding who's best, when really... most of the population, in my opinion, is being manipulated to think who's best. A lot of us don't think for ourselves. We have a sizable portion that's here, a sizable portion that's here, and the swing voters all decide like the night before they go to vote based on something. Who knows what it is? And the politicians understand that. Netanyahu, I'm not picking on Netanyahu, but, you know, it was a close election. And the day before the election, or 2 days before the election, he says something that sounds like, no Palestinian state. He didn't actually say that, but he said something very close to it. And as soon as he's elected, he said, I didn't say that. Is he a politician? Absolutely. He's very good. He's be the longest ruling Israeli prime minister. That's something to say over there. It's hard to stay in office over there because of the coalition style of government they have. Well, I'm not picking on him. I think that's the way politicians are. Say what they need to say. We have them in this country. They say what they need to say to get elected, and then they just go back on it. Sometimes we're blessed by having their advisors, and I won't name names here, but if you follow the news, you should know. Your particular advisor that advised a particular important politician to say a certain thing about a certain lightning issue some years ago. And, this individual said what the advisor told him to say, that he didn't believe at all. And you disavow it once you get in office. But you need the votes of the people that is their issue, that they're not going to vote for you if you don't agree with them on their own issue. So, anyway, people understand. People do understand that the heart's deceitful to a certain extent. I've said these already. Oh, entertainment, news media, I think all, this is entertainment especially. They have to understand what makes us tick in order to know what they can produce that we'll buy. Isaiah 11, talking about Messiah, right? The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the spirit of wisdom and understanding. The spirit of counsel and strength, the spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord. And then what? And he will not judge by what his eyes see. He will make a decision, nor make a decision by what his ears hear. But with righteousness he will judge. Now, why is it written like that? Because that's not normal. This individual is going to be different. Normal judging involves judging by what the eyes see and what the ears hear, not righteous judgment. It says, and decide with fairness for the afflicted of the earth. Righteous judgment is not normally what we get as human beings. Messiah comes, we'll have a different type of leader, which will make for an entirely different kind of society. It'll be wonderful. All right, I'm already here. I just wanted to briefly show some other. I got to get my Bible up here. Want to briefly show from the prophets from the Old Testament what we're dealing with. Now I want to go to the New Testament, and I want to spend a few minutes in the book of Matthew. If you can turn to Matthew, I'm not going to have these up on the screen. I'm just going to, I didn't count how many. The word hypocrite is used a lot of times in the New Testament. I would suspect that that the one book that word is used more frequently in than any other is the book of Matthew. For whatever reasons, Matthew decided to focus on that in his account. Matthew chapter 6. We'll start there. We're not going to look at every example of where Jesus used the word hypocrite, but we'll look at a bunch of them. I'll hold on to all this. Matthew chapter 6. Somebody want to read verses 1 to 4? You got any readers today? Sure, Tammy, thanks. Thank you. So what's Jesus' point here about doing alms? They were doing it for what?
Recognition.
And he's saying it shouldn't be that way. Now, is it wrong to do alms? No, of course not. Is it wrong to draw attention to doing alms? I'll give you an example why I say that you got to be careful how you apply this. What if You had a ministry in your, you live in Lititz, and you have a ministry to some of the poor people in Lititz. And you're able to serve them, and you're able to take donations that you're getting from the neighborhood and turn it into something good. Would it be wrong to somehow get that in the paper or have a picture? What do you think? I mean, you know where I'm coming from. I wouldn't have brought it up, but feel free to disagree. Would that be wrong or right? What do you think?
Depends on your motive.
Very good. Depends on your motive. Maybe you want to, maybe your motive is that you want to show the people that are donating that you really are doing something good with their money. And that would be appropriate. Or the motive could be showing off. Yeah, that would be bad. Now, I think Jesus' point here is that if you're doing something personally with your own resources, there's never a need to broadcast it. But I think in my mind, you know, in our local paper, probably yours too, you know, somebody donates $1,000 to some charity and they bring, you know, they got this check that's about 5 feet across and it takes 10 people to hold it. And you think, oh, they're drawing attention to themselves. Well, yes, they are. But on the other hand, people donated to make that possible. So, you know, I can, you know, there might be some bad motivation there. I don't know. I'm not their judge. But I can see that there could be a reason why you wanted to be responsive to the people that are donating. But, you know, Jesus isn't talking about that here. He's talking about you individually or me individually with my resources and my time serving somebody else, and I don't need to draw attention to that. In his society, apparently they did. It's hard to imagine that they literally tooted a trumpet, but that's what it says. or rang a bell or whatever they did. I think I've read that. Have you ever read in some other sources that they rang a bell at the, it's like the Salvation Army kettle, you know, you put money in there. That's not why they ring the bell there, but that there's a bell when they donated. But that was the society. And Jesus said that. You missed the point then. You know, God doesn't need your money. He's interested in what's going on in your heart, in my heart. How about verse 5 and 6? Somebody want to read that? Sure, thanks. Thank you. So here's another example. Is it wrong to pray in public? Yes or no? No, we do it here. We could do it more. Certainly many people who meet have more prayer in their service. And it's public in a way. I mean, they're not broadcasting it necessarily on the loudspeakers. But he's talking about our alms. Again, you know, the things that we do, praying. And apparently in their society, there were people that tried to draw attention to the fact that they were praying. And then, you know, as Jesus says several times here, they have their reward. They got the attention, they got their reward. That's hypocrisy. That's not what's going on inside. God's interested in what's going on inside. What's the motivation, as Jim said? That's what it's all about. It's about our motivation. Not necessarily about what we're doing. What we're doing could be good. If our motivation is wrong, like I said about the Pharisees. Pharisees did a lot of good works. But they had bad motivation for a lot of it, too. Well, we'll just read also about 16 to 18, 16, 17, and 18. Somebody want to read that? We're not going to read every example of hypocrisy here, but we'll read a few. Did I have a volunteer? You did? Okay, go ahead. What is that? What?
The message.
The message, okay. Well, it got the point, doesn't it? God doesn't need us to draw attention to ourselves. If that's the case, it's kind of like Elijah with the priests of Baal. You know, you got to shout louder to get God's attention or something. Obviously, we don't believe that we have to do that. So all of these things there in chapter 6, they have to do with trying, you know, what's our motivation? What are we trying to get attention? Are we trying to be noticed for doing something good? If we are, we got the entire, you know, it's all wrong on the inside, regardless of what we're doing on the outside. And I didn't put it here, but you know, didn't Jesus say something along the lines of, you know, people will come and say, haven't I done this? Haven't I done these good works? And list the good works to do. And he'll say, depart from me, those of you that won't obey me or something like that. I should have looked it up. Somebody could find it. You know, what's your motivation for doing it? and that's what these days are about. A lot about motivation. Why we do what we do. Are we going to be motivated by the ways of the world? Are we going to be motivated by a desire to please God and to serve Him and serve others? And that's what Jesus modeled for us. If we turn to Matthew chapter 7, verses 1 to 5. Somebody want to read that? Anybody different or no? Anybody's in a reading mood today? Okay, Tim. Now, you can agree with me or disagree with me on anything, obviously, but on this one. I think of all the things in these chapters here, that this one is at the top or near the top of the list in things that we in the Church of God, in our history and in our, you know, current, past, whatever, are guilty of. We're really good. I'm speaking for myself. Really good at noticing a problem over here or a problem over there. Or a problem over here. And obviously, I'm not going to be as good, according to what Jesus says, at seeing the problems that are here. And one of the reasons this is I'm focused here, here, and here. I'm focused all outside of me. Worrying about what your problems are, or somebody else's problems in some other group, or whatever. It could even be the world. I've known people in my church experience who I'm not trying to psychoanalyze them, but it's going to sound like that. I think that part of the way they felt good about themselves was to put down the people in the world. And they were better than those people. And sometimes they carried it over to people in the church as well. You'd have to be a psychologist to figure all that stuff out. But I think it's something we do to make ourselves feel better about ourselves. And we don't need to do that. We don't need to judge. God's our judge. God's the judge, you know, don't judge your, what's it say, don't judge your neighbor's servant or whatever. We need to learn, you know, we need to worry about our own things and not about those other things and being so judgmental. I just know in my history, my experience, I have been very judgmental of others. More so not outside of the church because I think, well, they know what they know and that's they're not guilty for what they don't know. But I've been critical of those in my same culture that didn't see things the way I did. Maybe you've been that way. Maybe you haven't. But that's something I think that we tend to do more so in the church. It's just part of our nature. Part of it, I think, is because of our history. If you go back to where we came from, and I don't mean recent history. I'm going back into the 19th century. You go back in history. It's been a divisive struggle of finding differences between one group and another, or one's part of the group and another part, and splits based on that. That's just historically what we've done. So maybe it's part of, as I said before, maybe it's part of our DNA, but it's a part we need to change or let God change. if anybody has any comments, feel free to like raise your hand and add or subtract from what I'm saying or whatever. This one just seems like it's very, very prevalent in our culture, in our church culture. And what you find, and I'm preaching to the choir, I hope here that you know, what we find is that if we have better insight into our own insides, how will that affect how we treat others? How? Anybody?
Be kinder?
More merciful?
More understanding.
Yeah, more understanding. We really see how we are, we're going to tend to be more merciful, less judgmental. Okay, just a couple more. I'm skipping some of them that are here in Matthew. I could have turned to several more. Maybe I'll tell you what they are. Fasting, judging. In Matthew 15, won't read that, but I'll just point it out. It talks about people that don't want to hear what God has to say. You know, it talks. He's calling people hypocrites because they don't. You know, Isaiah talked about you that you hear the word just like a song and you like it, but you don't really listen to what I'm saying. You draw near, but you're not really listening to what's going on. How about Matthew 16 and verses 1 to 4? Somebody want to read those? If somebody else reads, I don't have to put my glasses on. Sue, thank you. You got to get yours too. Sue's got it. Go ahead. Yeah.
Then the Pharisees and Sadducees came, and testing him, asked that he would show them a sign from heaven. He answered and said to them, "When it is evening, you say it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning, it will be foul weather today, for the sky is red and threatening. Hypocrites, you know how to discern the face of the sky, that you cannot discern the signs of the times. The wicked and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, and no sign shall be given to it except the sign of the prophet Jonah." And he left them and departed.
Now this is, thank you. This is one that's doesn't jump out at me, and I wonder, well, you know, what's Jesus so perturbed about that they asked for a sign? I mean, I might have been there and wanted a sign too. What was the problem? Why did he? And I had to, you know, read what other people said about it, and I didn't come up with this on my own. What is it that he's perturbed about here? What do you think? Or have you ever? Has it ever been a question to you? Is he just worried about people asking for a sign? A lack of faith. Okay, that's not what I had in mind, but it might be part of what I have.
Evil motive.
They had a bad motive. What was their motive? They were trying to trap him. Why? You know, they didn't. They were after him. So, yeah, the motivation was wrong. They didn't have faith in him, as Rita said. That's absolutely true. What was it they were questioning about him? His one word.
Authenticity.
Authenticity or another A word? Authority. Either one. They questioned, you know, why do we have to listen to you? Show us some kind of sign. Now, that's kind of, he already healed people. He'd done all kinds of signs. But they wanted some kind of sign. Why? To authenticate him. Now, who are you? Who are you to be telling us? We go back to whoever, Ezra, Nehemiah, Moses. We got the oral tradition. He argued with them one time and said, "Oh, we're children of Abraham." He said, "Well, if you're children of Abraham, you wouldn't be trying to kill me." You know, they had this pedigree that they thought made them something. And what pedigree did Jesus have? Well, he was the Son of God. But they didn't want to believe that. They didn't have faith in that, as Rita says. So what did they want to sign for? Because they did not believe he was who he said he was. They questioned his authority. And his answer to them really wasn't, "All right, I'll show you why I have authority." His answer is more like, "This should be obvious. You should see this. You don't need me to tell you. You can look at the sky and see what the weather's going to be like. Why can't you look at the signs of the times and see what's going on?" He wouldn't even answer them directly. He didn't try to justify where he got his authority. He said, "You shouldn't even need to know that." Another way of saying that, in my opinion, is, "All right, truth is truth no matter who says it. You shouldn't be worried about who I am." Not in this context, anyway. You don't need to worry about whose authority I have. Because truth is truth. If I speak truth, you ought to listen to it.
I'd like to comment on this. That
yeah. May well be. For the sake of the recording, Gary's saying that the whole account in Jonah may have been just so that Jesus, you know, just to to be that sign that Jesus is going to use. And I have to say, it probably is. It certainly use it that way. Absolutely. So I think this is a question of authority or authenticity, as Gary puts it. And we shouldn't, God can teach us no matter where. Okay, one last place to go look, and that's in Matthew 23, where the word is used a whole bunch of times, and we won't necessarily look at every single one. He says that the scribes and Pharisees sit in Moses' seat, so they had some authority. And yet he was critical of them for several reasons. Because they didn't do, they wouldn't do what they wanted other people to do. They loved the attention, it says in verse 6, the nice seats and all this kind of stuff. And they wanted to be called teacher, rabbi, master, and all that. And he said, that's not good. So he had criticisms of them. And, excuse me, they wanted to be seen. It's all about appearance. To be, how many times have you been in an environment, and it still exists, still out there, where someone in our tradition who is a leader of some sort insists that you call him mister, insists that you, come up and see him at a certain time, at a certain place, or whatever. I've had that happen. Had a guy, we were at a place where there are whole lots of people from different church areas. And he observed, this is a church pastor, observed that other church pastors had their people, whatever those people were, kind of meet him at the door, go to the sea with him, whatever. He noticed that. And when he came in, he didn't have that. Now, he's not the kind of guy that actually wanted that locally, but he felt bad because he didn't see it when he got in this other environment. And he actually said something to me about it. And I felt bad for him, and I felt bad because I guess I was supposed to go somehow make him feel better. But the whole point is that our culture was wrong. It's upside down. Those guys are getting paid to serve the others, not to be waited on by them. And even in his local area, he didn't act that way. But when he's around his peers, he felt that he was due a certain amount of respect because of how they acted. And I just thought, that was so sad to me. It was so sad that things were so upside down. It has to do with the station, this honor. We should honor each other. We should honor people for good work. I'm not saying that there shouldn't be honor due to other people, but not because they are supposed to be somebody in the church, and we got to call them by a special name, like whatever it is, master, mister, this, that, like Jesus says there. The point is to serve. Okay, enough of that. Let's go. I'll just read it. But woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men, for you neither go in yourselves, neither suffer them that are, allow them that are entering to go in. And what's that mean? How could they shut up the kingdom of heaven? Any ideas? I have ideas, but how can they keep somebody out? In a way. Now, maybe literally they can't. God's going to do what he wants to do, obviously. But how do their practices serve to exclude people? Yes. Excellent answer there. Poor examples themselves. How else could they exclude people? Making people discouraged. Making the bar so high that people say, I can't do that. When they don't do it themselves, as Jesus said. Somebody else had their hand up?
Yeah, I was going to say. A combination of the two.
Okay.
I can't remember what it was.
All right.
False teacher.
They also had their own, one of the problems that Jesus was constantly critical of them for was having their own version of holiness that wasn't in the scripture. This handed down tradition from, and some of that was, in his opinion, was an obstacle to others. And I think that's part of this too. that was why they were hypocrites, because they put these bars, these high bars in front of everybody and made it difficult. Not that they could literally keep people out of the kingdom, but in their way of thinking that your entrance to the kingdom was becoming part of the people of God, which means the Jews at that time, and their bar of joining them and becoming one of them was so high that they, in effect, were trying to keep people out. All right. 14. Woe unto you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites, for you devour widows' houses and for a pretense make long prayer. How could they devour widows' houses? They actually took care of widows. They actually did collections and distributed goods to widows. But how do you think maybe they devoured widows' houses? How would we do that today?
Take their Social Security.
Take their assets. Yeah. I mean, make them feel like somehow or another they've got to support the church when they are at a stage in their life that they need to be supported. Not that they wouldn't try to help, I'm saying, but, you know, put burdens on them. You've got to give X number percent of your, you know, income, your Social Security, whatever. Or you need to leave your estate to the church, your assets. You know, you got a house, your husband died, you got your house, you need to sell your house and give it to the church. Does that sound far-fetched? That's being done today. That's being done today. Being preached today. It's sick. There's all kinds of ways we can do that. By taking advantage of those that need to be supported. And we can, the Pharisees and their cleverness were actually appeared to be supportive of the very people they were taking advantage of. Because, oh, they take the collections, they distribute to the widows. But then they had this Corbin, right? And I've talked about Corbin before. Most of you have heard that. I'll repeat it anyway, where you could, as a younger person, had elderly parents that were still alive, you could dedicate your assets to the temple, and then you didn't have to give to support your parents. And then when your parents died, you could rescind. It was a revocable thing. You could say, oh, by the way, I'm not going to give it to the temple. But as long as you dedicated to the temple, you were free from having to provide for your parents, and Jesus was really upset about that one. So at the same time they were appearing to take care of these people, they were on the, you know, pulling the rug out from under them on the other side. That's what Jesus was so upset about. They were hypocrites. They didn't have the right motivation, as Jim said. Okay. Let's see. Verse 15. Woe unto you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites, you compass sea and land to make one proselyte, and then you make him twofold more the child of hell than yourselves. You try to make them, you know, as bad as what you are by all these extra rules, all the traditions, all that kind of stuff. And it's about numbers. You know, we got to go get these people. You know, to their credit, they were evangelizing, but Jesus found fault with why? Because it was all about getting the numbers and controlling them. Now, we covered these before in other messages. Verse 23, they paid the tithe on the mint and the anise and the cumin, and they needed to worry more about justice, mercy, and faith. You know, it's all of that. It's not just doing the justice, mercy, and faith and not being obedient, but it's let's have the right motivation and be obedient. Be obedient for the right reasons. Straining a gnat and swallowing a camel. Most of you were here when I talked about that. They had this argument as to whether or not eating the larva of insects was a clean, would make them unclean or not. And in some schools of the Pharisees and Sadducees, or Pharisees, I guess, in particular, to ingest a larva of a gnat would make you unclean. So they strained their wine before they drank it so that they wouldn't ingest insect larvae. And they were worried about that kind of stuff. They were really worried about being clean. And you say, well, that's good, right? I mean, Tammy's reading that horrible stuff from Leviticus, you know, with these diseases and things that made people unclean. The Pharisees were all over that. They had the rules about how they're not going to be contaminated by all this. That's not wrong, but if that's what your religion is, you're missing the point of it. And to a certain extent, Jesus is saying that's what their religion was, staying pure, clean from all the impurities around them and all the impure people. And so that gave them a different perspective on the rest of the world. It wasn't healthy. Okay. Just want to read. Now, we talked about these before, so I'll just read them. Verse 25. Woe, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, you may clean the outside of the cup and the platter. Right, and we talked about that. They were concerned about whether the outside could make the inside unclean and vice versa, and they had arguments about that. He's saying, you know, it's kind of like he says, you need to be clean on the inside, he says in verse 26. Clean the inside of the cup and platter, so then the outside will be clean also. And the whited sepulchres, you know, that they would put whitewash on the tomb so that people wouldn't, on the way to the Passover, would not be contaminated by touching them or sleeping nearby them or whatever. And he said, you are like those whitewashed tombs. You look good on the outside, but inside you're full of dead bones. You're rotten. And he didn't mince words with him, did he? He said, you know, you say if you would have been alive when at the time of the prophets, you wouldn't have killed them, but you would have. You're the same as they are. You're the same. You're the same as your forefathers. You say the right things. You think you act the right way that you think is going to be noticed by others. He said, but inside, you're rotten. And that's a good message for us now because we have the same tendency. We're human beings. Inside, our insides can tend to be rotten. And we need to look there. And we need to look and see, as Jim says, what is the motivation? Maybe we do some good things from a wrong motivation. Maybe we aren't even doing the good things. But the point is, it's what's inside that matters, not what's outside. It really doesn't matter. Because Jesus said the sins come from the inside, right? Said that in Mark 9, you know, the uncleanness comes from the inside. So if our insides are clean, our outsides will be clean automatically. We won't have to worry about it. And to conclude the sermon, I just want to share another piece of literature that I've referred to before that explains a lot.
Now the star-bellied sneetches had bellies with stars. But the plain-bellied sneetches had none upon Mars. No stars on their bellies. No stars upon Mars. Now those stars weren't so big. They were really quite small. You would think such a thing wouldn't matter at all. But because they had stars, all the star-bellied sneetches would brag.
We're the best kind of sneetch on the beaches.
With their snoots in the air, they would sniff and they'd snort. They'd have nothing to do with a plain belly sort.
Ronald, remember, when you are out walking, you walk past a sneetch of that type without talking. Keep your snoot in the air and remember to snort. We have no truck whatever with the plain bellied sort.
When the star-bellied children went out to play ball, could a plain belly get in the game? Not at all. You only could play if your bellies had stars, and the plain belly children had none upon theirs.
Yeah,
yeah,
your
belly's got no stars.
Twinkle, twinkle, lovely little star.
Twink, twink, twinkle, twinkle, stupid little star.
If there's one upon your tummy, that's just yummy, you're my chummy.
If there isn't, you're a crummy, slummy, gummy, bummy, dummy.
That applies likewise to daddy and your mommy.
Twink, twink, twinkle, twinkle, lovely little star. Twink, twink, twinkle, twinkle, stupid little star.
When the star-bellied sneetches had frankfurter roasts, or picnics, or parties, or marshmallow toasts, they never invited the plain-bellied sneetches. They left them out cold in the dark of the beaches. They kept them away, never let them come near. That's how they treated them year after year. They got snubbed, they got snooted, their bottoms got booted, while the star-bellied sneetches all taunted and hooted.
They just are not suited. No stars upon bars.
Then one day, it seems, while the plain-bellied sneetches were moping and doping alone on the beaches, just sitting there wishing their bellies had stars, a stranger approached in the strangest of cars.
My friends, I have seen they've been treating you mean. My name is Sylvester McMonkey McBean. I know precisely why you are so unhappy, and that I can fix. I'm the fix-it-up chappie. prices are low, and I work with great speed, and my work is 100% guaranteed. By my new patent process of polar potoxis of the inner subnuclear noose bomb Nogoxis, you'll get a star like the star-bellied Sneech for the mere paltry payment of $3 each.
A star? Here?
Yes, my friend, there. And the first to go through gets the trip at half fare. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
It works!
Yeah! It works! It works!
Them over there, they got stars upon theirs. And we over here, we got stars upon ours. We got them all, so we got them too. For every little bitty bit is goody good as you. Now we're socially acceptable at Marshmallow Toast. You'll have to send us invitations to your Frankfurter roast. Stars, stars, bless our lucky stars. All the Sneeches on the beaches now got stars upon thars.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are faced with a most awkward dilemma. We're the true star bellies. We had them first. We're still the best Sneeches, and they're still the worst.
Yeah! But how are we going to prove it? Which is which? I can't tell us apart.
Let me through. Excuse me. Step aside, please. Thank you. You don't know me, my friends, but calm down if you can. I'm here to help the original star belly clan. Those upstarts, it's true, now have stars just like you. But follow me, my friends, and you know what I'll do. I'll make you again the best Sneeches on the beaches. And all it will cost you is $10 each. Belly stars, my dear friends, are no longer in style. And I'll have yours off in a very short while in my wondrous machine which eradicates stars. Then you won't look like Sneeches who have them on bars.
Eradicates these?
Eradicates these with the greatest of ease, provided you pay your $10, if you please.
Here's 10 for the boy and 10 for me.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
How distinctive.
How exclusive.
Now we know who is who, and there isn't a doubt. The best kind of Sneeches are Sneeches without the old-fashioned custom of walking about. With stars on your belly is O-U-T, out, out, O-U-T, out. That old status symbol is O-U-T.
Then, of course, those with stars all got frightfully mad. To be wearing a star now was frightfully bad. Then, of course, old Sylvester McMonkey McBean invited them into his star-off machine.
Thank you. Thank you.
From then on, as you probably guessed, things really got into a horrible mess. All the rest of that day, on those wild, screaming beaches, the fix-it-up chappie kept fixing up Sneeches. Off again, on again, in again, out again, through the machines they raced round and about again, changing their stars every minute or two. They kept paying money. They kept running through until neither the plane nor the star bellies knew whether this one was that one, or that one was this one, or which one was what one, or what one was who. Then, when every last cent of their money was spent, the fix-it-up chap packed up, and he went. And he laughed as he drove his car up the beach.
They never will learn. No, you can't teach a Sneech.
But McBean was quite wrong. I am happy to say that the Sneetches got really quite smart on that day. That day they decided that Sneetches are Sneetches, and no kind of Sneetch is the best on the beaches. That day all the Sneetches forgot about stars, and whether they had one or not upon Thars.
I, for one, am... I'm not going to take my shirt off and show you one way or the other, but I'm tired of worried about whether people have stars upon Thars or not. I thought I'd share that. Some of you hadn't read the book or seen it, and thought maybe that would... our young people would relate to that. That's what I've been talking about. It really doesn't matter what's on the outside. It matters what's going on in here, in your heart, in your head. And this is a good time of year to think about that, that God cares what's going on inside.